Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to our podcast on CelticUnderground.net. You've been doing this for a very, very long time now because the longest running Celtic fans podcast on the internet is 250 podcasts old. Thanks to everybody for listening to, commenting on Twitter, listening to us online and making reference to us everywhere. Thanks for Eddie Pearson, myself, St. Anthony, James Kelly and every guest that we've had, Hullboy, Mark Cameron, Mark Cooper, Lackey Moore, Tony Hamilton, players, ex-players, although I don't know why I say players, because I can't think of a current player we've had in the podcast. Anyway, that's irrelevant. This is podcast number 250 from CelticUnderground.net. The season finished, but the podcasts haven't. Podcast number 251 is actually being recorded in less than 24 hours' time. It'll be up sometime again the next week or something like that. Anyway, we've had our special guests in the last wee while, most recently Stephen Purcell talking about Celtic, faith and the Labour Party. So I decided to make sure that it was a Celtic fans podcast for podcast number 250. So this week I am joined by St. Anthony, author of 10 Men Won the League, Marco Cooper. Mark is a South American correspondent who bangs the drum about why Celtic don't have a scouting network over there. Mark Cameron, lefty boy, who is coordinator of the fans for the Celtic FC Foundation extraordinaire and appears left, right and centre following the hoops. And at By The Men Celtic and at By The Men Empire pioneer, Mr. Lawrence Donegan. And apologies are passed on by Mr. Lackey Moore, who couldn't get the technology to work, and Hullboy, who had to go into a phone box and change into Super Labour Man to save the day for the Labour Party. So, enough of me telling you who's on the podcast. The reason for the so many Celtic fans on the podcast is tonight we decided to have a review of the season. So we start with Neil Lennon's departure. Have a very long chat that runs up to the Champions League game. Or Champions League debacle, I should say, and then managed to condense the rest of the season into about 10 minutes before we talk about what we expect for the coming year. Overall consensus, Ronnie Dyle at the beginning, fingers crossed Ronnie Dyle at the end. We never knew we were happy until we got Ronnie. But enough from me. This is me, Harry Brady, saying once again thanks everybody for listening and downloading to 250 of our podcasts. Hopefully there'll be another 250 plus more. And this is them, the Celtic Underground team, giving you a season-long review. The 250th podcast of the Celtic Underground, the longest running podcast on the web, and I think we'd all agree the best quality one on the web. joining us are St. Anthony, Mark Cameron, lefty boy, Mark Cooper, and a special guest getting to, a bit like when Hugh Keevans used to pretend he was a broadsheet journalist, Mr. Lawrence Donegan.
That's twice you've done that. Compare me to Hugh Keevan.
Right, so to start off, this is going to be a season review. So to start off, I'm going to ask everybody's question, this one question, then we'll open it up to the floor. If we start the season at the end of the last season, Lawrence, were you surprised that Neil Lennon left?
I was surprised he hadn't left the summer before, to be honest, given everything that I'd been told. I'd been told that relations were, what's the word I'm looking for?
Strained.
That I think there was a kind of mutual feeling that everybody should leave. And I might be wrong, but the story was he just didn't get an offer of another job. So he stood around for another year. He waited for, and, you know, he should have gone the year before, shouldn't he? I mean, we did well, but it was a bad European campaign, and it's just kind of a sense of a regime decaying. Not that it was a terrible year. So, not to answer your question, not in the slightest bit surprised.
And Mark Cooper, were you surprised?
No. No, especially after the... Remember Shakhtar Karagandy interview? It seemed quite clear, like, after that, he was kind of pretty critical of the board and the lack of transfer spend. And also, all you guys who know have more info than me. There's always, like, whispers that, you know, he was going to be heading off within a year or fairly soon anyway.
And you, Mark Cameron, because you're in the know, you travel everywhere with Celtic, you're cheap by jail with the people in the know at Celtic Park. Was it a surprise to you?
First of all, Harry, I'm not really in the know, but to answer the question, I am absolutely with Lawrence on this one. I was surprised that he was still the manager for that final season. My surprise was that he didn't leave two summers ago, and I think after you know, the good season he had with the Champions League and winning the league, and his final season he wasn't offered a new contract on enhanced terms, I think that kind of told you that you know, maybe he wasn't as highly rated as some people thought. And yeah, I think similar to Lawrence, I think if there was another club had come in with something that was substantial or in the Premiership, then I think he would have left that season. So was it a surprise when he went last summer? Not at all. I think to be honest, the timing was right, Harry, for him to go, and obviously that gave us a problem with getting someone else in time for the Champions League qualifiers. But no, I wasn't surprised when he left last summer.
So, St. Anthony, the only way to avoid everybody saying nobody was surprised, were you surprised?
Not so much surprised, but disappointed when he left, because I think there's a lot of people don't show any appreciation in the basket case of a club that he took over in 2010. And again, I don't think he gets the credit for turning it around. And his success in the transfer market in the main was actually very good, but when you analyse it. The other thing that Lennon had gone from was he navigated us through difficult waters in the Champions League qualifiers. And that's something that Ronnie Dyla has still to do. That's not a criticism of Ronnie Dyla. It's just that I think we actually take for granted somehow that we're going to come through these qualifiers. Well, Legia Warsaw last summer was quite a sobering thought and an eye-opener to a lot of people. But not surprised at his departure, for the point of view that if you heard the stories, and sometimes you can't separate the wood from the trees, but he didn't have a stable private life and things were happening, and perhaps it was best all around that he left when he left.
So Marco Cooper, what were you looking for in a new manager? I'm asking you, since you're a man in South America who's always, did you want a guy with a passport problem or?
Well, to be honest, yeah, I'm not sure if we could have got a work permit for an Argentinian manager, so maybe not. I wanted someone who was going to be playing one up front.
Just like say.
No, I wanted... to be honest, what I was looking for was someone who was young, wanted to play possession football, already had European experience in the Champions League, and worked very well with a very small budget. Like, the person who I was thinking of was the Serbian guy who was he was in charge of what the Cypriot team who did really well, and I thought that was a kind of a logical, you know, route to go down. Like, he had a budget that was about, you know, a third of ours, and he had got to quarterfinals. So that's what I was kind of hoping for. I'll be honest, I was slightly underwhelmed when we got Dyla.
Was anybody else underwhelmed on Ronnie Dyla, Lawrence?
Well, I'm just laughing. You're a typical Mark. I wanted to accept the Serbian guy who was in charge of the Cypriot team. Too much Jonathan Wilson for you, pal.
And people listening to this can't see, he's also got a beard now.
He's also got a beard. But just to jump on St. Anthony there, he makes a good point about Lennon. You know, maybe people kind of wrote him off. He did a great job. I mean, it was a total basket case. However, in defence of Strachan failed in his first year in Europe. Lennon failed in his first year in Europe. So I think we'll give Ronnie one as well. But as to, wasn't underwhelmed, but I was just delighted that we didn't get Roy Keane. I couldn't believe that, you know? And it's very amusing to me. It's very amusing to me that Peter Lawwell sort of striding around wherever he strides around with his chest puffed out, you know, found this great manager. Let nobody forget that Dyla was his third choice, that Larson was his first choice, that Roy Keane was his second choice, and he sort of stumbled into Ronnie D. So let that be remembered.
Yeah, Matt Cameron, Lawrence makes a good point there. We forget the people that were being talked about as replacements. Oh. I was actually, rather than being underwhelmed with Ronnie, I was more in fear as to who we might get.
Oh. I think undoubtedly we dodged a bullet with Roy Keane. Henrik Larsson. I wasn't sure about Henrik, to be honest with you. I thought he was a bit young, and you know, you just sometimes wonder if it was, you know, if it would work out for him as successfully as a manager with Celtic as what was an absolute icon as a player. But yeah, I mean, the guys make some valid points in terms of he was nowhere near first choice. So when we eventually got him, I wasn't particularly underwhelmed. I was very fascinated. My concern, I think, was around his pedigree in Europe, because I think ultimately that's where our managers for the next 5 to 10 years will be judged on their success.
You said that Keane was Lowell's second choice, but in the whole kind of process, like, I don't really have any information, but I assumed that Keane was Desmond's choice, and Lowell didn't especially want him. With the kind of at his time, right?
I've heard that as well, actually, in fairness. So you maybe we'll give Peter a slight break. But, you know, well, I mean, just to throw the gossip out there, the story was that so Lawwell talks to Keane, this might be complete rubbish, and does his best to put him off.
I
mean,
I think we've all heard that story.
So if it's true, then well done. Peter, puff your chest out, Peter, if you want.
I heard Peter was doing cartwheels when Roy Keane knocked it back.
Well, again, we're talking, Lefty, we're talking wheels within wheels here, you know. You know, spin within spin within spin. I mean, who knows? I mean, the good news is that we ended up at Dyla, which I think is, I mean, obviously the benefit of 12 months hindsight is was a great choice.
Yeah, I getting back to the Roy Keane thing, I just can't see that Peter Lawwell would have looked forward to managing Roy Keane.
Oh, well, exactly.
No.
What were you saying? What were yours?
Well, Lawrence has stolen my thunder slightly but mentioning Roy Keane, because I don't think there's any doubt if Roy Keane became the manager, he wouldn't have been there by Christmas. Not because he's a bad manager or anything else particular, because quite frankly, he's a basket case and he would have found somebody he fought with. He probably would have felt it with the supporters. There's a whole number of things that could have happened. The only thing that concerns me slightly with Ronnie Dyla is, to make this point, I think John Collins was appointed before Ronnie Dyla, which I think tended to put him in a position of weakness, because if he had any strength whatsoever, he would have stood up possibly to Peter Lawwell and demanded his own backroom team. I mean, if you go back in time, I always remember that, like, David Hay, when he replaced Billy McNeil, he was told that Frank Connor was going to be his assistant manager, and 18 months later, Davey Hay ended up sacking him because clearly the two guys weren't compatible. Now, I'm not saying that's the case between Collins and Dyla. They seem to be working in tandem, and if that's the case, that's terrific. But my only concern is that there's a friend of mine that he keeps making the point that he wants a manager who will stand up to the board and demand relevant funds to go out and make a difference. But my point is that we haven't had a manager like that since Martin O'Neill, and the board are not going to employ anybody like that. So I'm actually very pleased with getting Ronnie Dyla, and I'm actually very pleased at the outcome of the season, and more importantly, I'm very optimistic for the future.
See your point there about... I sometimes see people saying we need a guy who stands up to the board. What company in the world employs somebody who's going to be a pain in the arse to them? I've never understood this concept. We want a guy who's permanently at odds with his bosses, because that's going to create a smooth running
Alex
harmony.
Ferguson.
Well, Alex Ferguson Ferguson's not on great with the Glazers.
Glazers, exactly.
Only because he get his wings clipped.
Well, hang on a sec. But I didn't want to jump in there saying, because I thought you'd think I might be piling on you. But that's a terribly old-fashioned view of football, that the manager has to be fighting with the board all the time. Like in a modern football club, everybody's working in concert. You know,
yeah,
I mean, that seems to me to be a modern 21st century football club. This idea that the manager has constantly been arguing with the board or whatever...
Let's get back to Lennon then. The one thing that Lennon was looking for when Hooper left that he didn't manage to get was a quality striker. The money that was coming into the club at that time, I think Lennon was entitled to go up a wee notch in terms of a class player. And the board obviously wanted him to get C class players, where we're never going to get A class players. But we might get a decent B somewhere along the lines if we were to go out there in a limb and spend a wee bit more money for a set position. In this day and age, if you really want quality, particularly up front, then you really have to pay a wee bit more. And I just think that Lennon was entitled to a bit of support for the board that wasn't forthcoming.
Harry, can I just come in here?
Yeah, Mark.
Just going back to the point the guys are making about a manager who stands up to the board, I think we must have that in Ronnie Dyla, because for the last 5 years, in pre-season training, we've jetted halfway around the world, taking up lucrative friendlies, and the players are coming back absolutely knackered with jet lag into Champions League qualifiers, and look what's happening this season. That's a fundamental change for our football club, and in that must be in no small way down to what Ronnie has spoke to the board about. So he must be standing up to the board saying, look, all this travelling, globe-trotting around the world isn't helping our preparations for the Champions League qualifiers. And he must have put his foot down, and we're going to see the results and hopefully the benefits of that over the next couple of months, and hopefully we make it into the Champions League.
The board did make an offer for a striker, which would have been the largest kind of offer since we were going for Sutton and Hartson for a Champions League striker, and it was knocked back. I'm not sure if it was Lennon's choice, but we definitely put in a large offer for some.
Who was it, Mark?
I don't know who it is.
A Champions League striker who's...
Spit it out, man! This is a Celtic Underground podcast. We can libel anyone.
I can't even pronounce a guy's name. A Greek guy.
A Greek guy.
At Fulham.
Oh, yeah.
So far, we've got a Greek guy, a Serbian guy, a Cypriot guy.
So, Lawrence, you said you know who it was we put the money in
right.
for.
Well, first things first. Lefty Boy made a brilliant point about the summer tour. No summer tour. And I think that might be something to do with... But it's common sense, you know? Now, Saints talking about backing... Lennon wanted to sign Finn Bogason. That's who he wanted, from Herving, the Dutch club. And he went to Real Sociedad for €8 million. You know how many goals he scored this season? 2. And now he's available on loan. Right? So that's... You know, so £5 million... doesn't necessarily get you. Oh, wait, stop!
Well, look at the name of the Greek player and we can't even pronounce it.
exactly.
Right? So, and not necessarily, you know, that, you know, if Lennon had got his way, we'd be stuck with a £5 million dud.
It is the problem of football inflation that actually, I'm not sure. And some people listen to this will now shoot me down for this. I'm not sure there's a massive difference between a £2-3 million player and a £4 million player. I think there's a difference between a £2-4 million player and an £8-9 million player.
I think there's also a difference in where you spend that money. I don't want to, you know, sound like a broken record, but I think if you do spend it in the more peripheral markets, if you have to go to Eastern Europe and spend the difference between a £4 million player. The £4 million player from Romania will be like the young star who's coming through. A £2 million player from, you know, Romania, Serbia will be Skekovic.
Which reminds me,
But who was it that we were interested in this week from Chile, Mark?
Apparently, I saw there's a Daily Record journalist, McCarthy,
yep,
who completely dismissed that. But it's weird, the Spanish paper AS, they have a Chilean edition, and the Colo Colo directors, like, apparently, according to AS, they confirmed it, sorry, that we had put in an offer and that they were going to decide whether or not they're going to accept it. But that was dismissed, like, today.
Well,
by the Daily Record gang. So.
I touch on that only because of your point that we maybe are looking further afield, but what we've just gone through there then gets us into the squad that Ronnie Dyla took into the Champions League qualifiers, and probably to talk about whether that squad was ready or not, and what happened in the Champions League qualifiers. So Mark Cameron, lefty boy, what did you think going into the qualifiers? Did you think he had the right squad? And then what did you make of the qualifiers? Were you starting to have doubts about Ronnie even at that point?
I think booting into the qualifiers, I mean, it was only, barely 5.5 weeks between Ronnie being appointed and the first game in Reykjavik. So that was a bit of a concern, obviously. And then his lack of experience in Europe, I think, was an issue for me, and probably still is. I think he needs to prove himself in Europe. But going into the qualifiers, it was definitely a concern. And the fact that the home games were at Murrayfield, I was, you know, wondering how the players would react here. I have to say, going to Murrayfield was an absolute pleasure. The atmosphere was great. And, you know, in the first game against Reykjavik, I think it ended up about 4-0, and it looked pretty comfortable. So from then on, I thought, yeah, we're the seeded team. We should navigate our way through the qualifiers. Then we had the collapse against Warsaw, and, you know, that was obviously a huge deal and a huge disappointment. And then the Maribor thing just didn't work for us at all either, did it? So the qualifiers was hugely disappointing. And to an extent, you can understand why some people thought this guy's not going to make it. But as you say, it wasn't any. Was it really that much different from Gordon Strachan not making it and Neil Lennon not making it in Europe in their first season? And they needed time to adjust. So yeah, hugely disappointing going into the qualifiers. And I think fairly early on in the season, Ronnie Dyla was still trying to adjust and find out, you know, who his best players were.
Well, Saint, just before I go on, just to let you know, Mark Cooper is he's in a torture chamber at the moment. So when you hear the screams in the background, that's some of the victims getting their fingernails pulled out. Saint, you weren't sure about Celtic playing at Murrayfield. That was part of your problem for the Champions League qualifiers.
That still rankles with me a wee bit, and I'm not going to reopen the old wounds begging over it again. But I think the thing that done Ronnie in against Legia Warsaw was, that was the first time there's been a threat to us in the draw. Now, but before that, when we came through the qualifiers, it was teams like Karagandy and Elfsborg, and the season before that, I think it was Helsinki and a Swedish team who escaped.
Elfsborg.
No, Elfsborg was the second season. The one before that was Helsingborg, wasn't it? The point I'm making is that those are teams, with the greatest respect to them, that Celtic should be confident of beating over two legs. But when we drew Legia Warsaw, they're the champions of Poland. I think that they were in quite a false position. Their probably position in the game might have been a wee bit higher than that. They were probably a seeded team, in theory, who were unseeded. So for the first time in a few years, we found ourselves really up against it. But again, playing the second leg at Murrayfield wasn't the ideal for a playing point of view. Even though the fans managed to get through in great numbers and give their support. But the other thing is that the first leg as well, we were actually doing quite well in the first leg until... Who gets sent off?
In the first leg?
Mm.
Oh.
Was it Ambrose or Van Dijk?
Van Dijk. Van Dijk get sent off for...
No. Was it not Ambrose?
Ambrose or Van Dijk?
Ambrose.
I can't remember, but again, I'm talking about circumstances. We were doing okay up until the sending off. There's no way if I'd have kept 11 players in the park, would have took a 4-1 down. And even getting into the last 10 minutes, I remember turning around to my friend when we were watching it and saying, if he can come back here with a 2-1 defeat, we've won a watch. And then before you know it, there's two aberrations in defence and you're 4-1 down. So
yeah,
I did feel really sympathy for Ronnie, because I think there was things happening in about him that he'd no control over.
I think his substitutions were really naive though, right? Like, he left Commons on to be a lone striker, and he had Berget on from the start, who'd barely even trained with him.
Yeah, but like, I did sort of understand the Berget thing, because Berget knew Ronnie Dyler.
Yeah, but he didn't know his own player.
Squad. Yes. So I'm just looking at the team, right? There's one player, well, I'm talking about the second leg where we're going to beat 2-0. There's one player, and one dialer player, and it's Berget, and he's on the bench, and the whole, the 17 or 18, whoever's, so you're stripped that night. There's one player, he's picked one player. So that must have been hard for him.
Did Scott Brown not get injured around about that time as well?
That was forgotten.
Yeah, Scott Brown, he was injured. A big loss. I know that I get...
I've just fallen off my chair. And Anthony's just said Scott Brown's a loss.
Contrary to opinion, I've never actually said Scott Brown's a bad player, right? And again, I'm not going to get into the ins and outs of the Twitter arguments on a podcast. But the thing is, at that time, Ronnie needed his experienced men and his best team at his disposal. And there's no doubt that Scott Brown missing was a big loss.
And as I say, he had one player of his own there, and it was that big Diddy, Berget. I mean, really. But just jumping on with Saint, with Mark there, I don't know whoever was talking about. What if it was actually, like, I went to the game against the Icelandic mob, and that was actually, apart from the just shocking parking, by the way. It was quite a nice experience. Butterfield was actually, it was a decent atmosphere. It wasn't anywhere near full, but it was a decent atmosphere. That giant, that colossus, Timo Pukki scored twice as well, if I remember rightly.
Do you know, I actually, because you're watching with a new manager and you're thinking, right, okay, what's going to happen with the new manager is by the time we get to February of next season, there'll only be three or four, as you pointed out, Lawrence, there'll only be three or four of the existing team who will still be there. A bit, you know, it's a bit like Martin O'Neill's first team has got Stephen Mahe in it and Johnny Gould and Stuart Kerr's on the bench and things like that. And then you look to later and you think it's not going to change. And you're trying to guess who the players are. And I remember looking at Pukki in that game thinking, maybe Pukki will be able to do something.
But you fielded as well, Harry.
Yeah, because you're thinking, there must be a player in this guy, because Bundesliga teams have looked at him. He didn't look like anything last season. Maybe it was just he'll fit into the Ronnie Dyler system.
Well, he came from Schalke.
Yeah,
I mean, he was playing with likes of Drexler and all that. I mean, world class players. Yeah, it's unbelievable. And he pitches up at us. Although apparently he's done so well in Denmark now that Brøndby can't afford to buy him. Maybe if we, there's that many people on this podcast, if we have a whip round, we might be able
to. Yes, exactly.
The point about Pukki is, he's one of those guys who just never ever looked happy. In fact, the only time I ever seen him happy was when he was getting substituted and coming off the park.
The problem with Pukki is, say, he didn't play in a two up front with a big tall guy knocking him down for him.
I actually thought Pukki might suit a one up front more than a two up front.
I think with Pukki's concern that there was nothing up front and Pukki in the bench.
But he just didn't like the physicality, did he? He wasn't interested in the physicality, and that was the beginning, middle, and end of him, you know.
Yeah, he wasn't interested in the Scottish game at all.
And, and the final one of the Champions League qualifiers was the Maribor catastrophe. And the thing is, we should have actually had that tie over with in the game in the first leg.
Can I talk about
over there?
So I'm saying, you can go on, you go.
The biggest disappointment of the season for me was getting beat with Maribor. Not because I think Maribor are a particularly bad team, or that we've got any divine right to beat Maribor, but there's two things that happened in the first leg that were really, really vital. Now, the first thing is, I don't know if anybody remembers this, they took centre and they totally retreated into the edge of their own penalty box for almost the entire first half. I've never seen anything like it away from home in Europe. They made no attempt virtually to attack, although they scored a goal on the break. And I think that Ronnie was actually taken aback that night, and I hesitate to use this phrase, but he looked as if he wasn't sure what to do, because a week for home in Europe, a couple of away goals would serve you really well. And we did take the lead, and then we equalised. Another thing that really cost us that night, does anybody remember Van Dijk's header was net bound and it hit Johansson in the face?
Best defensive effort of the season.
Yes.
Well, I was honestly, I remember watching that night and I was nearly in tears because it just struck me at the time that is so vital at that level. It's we sort of like it twists your fate like that can make you or break you. And in the second leg against Maribor, Ronnie wasn't sure whether to twist or stick because we started the game with the advantage of the one each away goal. But the longer the game went, the more nervous the fans got, the more nervous the players got. And you could almost sense a goal coming. And when Maribor scored, I don't think anybody was particularly surprised.
No, I think you're right. The away leg in Maribor, if we had come back 2-1 up, there was just no chance that we wouldn't go through. So, yeah, the disappointment in the away leg. But when it comes to the home game, you would have to be expecting that we're going to beat them. That was a huge, huge disappointment. Probably the biggest disappointment of the season, even more so than the Scottish Cup semi-final, which we'll probably talk about later as well, I would imagine.
Well, the irony was, Mark, that Legia Warsaw, who we played in the previous round, in theory were an inferior team to Maribor in terms of the coefficient, were a far, far better team than Maribor.
Well, that's right.
Which I think we need to be careful in these Champions League qualifiers and not to take anything for granted, because there is occasionally a Legia Warsaw lurking about in these draws, and it's important that we try and avoid that, because, you know, with the greatest respect, that you know, that these are teams that are very difficult to beat.
Right, Lawrence?
Well, two things. Second leg, if you remember, didn't he bring Commons on? I mean, that was his. I think he brought Commons on. He played Commons from the start. He just came into the press.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were attacking. What the hell are we attacking for with 20 minutes to go? Well, we don't need to score. You know, so we're caught in the break and they score. We're up front. I can't quite remember the circumstances of the goal. But there's no need for us to be attacking. So that, I think tactically, that was the lowest point of his season. It really was. And the other thing, the Saints got a great point. There are good teams looking. Maribor went on into the Champions League with, I think, Chelsea's group. And they got 3 points. So they weren't mugs. They were definitely not mugs. They were a decent team.
Yeah. And then, so after we get knocked out by Maribor, we then have the end of the transfer window and we sign Skepovic and Guidetti, although it was really odd because we were after Skepovic, we then in the last second are about to loan Guidetti, and then Skepovic deal comes back on, then the Skepovic deal comes back on.
It was the whole transfer dealings, it seemed really incoherent. Like, we bought 3 attacking left midfielders, Tonev, Wakaso and Berget. And by November, Anthony Stokes was the left-sided attacker. We buy 2 strikers in Skepovic and what's his name, Guidetti, after the Champions League qualifiers.
Yeah. And that was the thing. We all knew we needed a striker because Hooper had left and none of the existing strikers were good enough. We all knew we needed a striker. We were told the problem is we can't get the strikers that we need until we know whether we're playing Champions League football or not. We find out we're not playing Champions League football, and the next day we sign 2 strikers of the standard that we were looking at prior to the Champions League, being in the Champions League. None of it made any sense at all.
I felt at the time that the club were just running about trying to get the players in, and the fact that they didn't get them in before Maribor, really, for our club, we should be well ahead of that and make sure we've got our squad in and settled long before the final Champions League qualifiers, because that's without doubt one of the most important games of the season. And then to bring these 2 guys in was just after, it was quite literally after the horses bolted.
It just didn't make any sense. And as you say, for me, it was also compounded because Ronnie had been there, as you said before, Mark, 5 weeks before the transfer window, Ronnie had been in situ. There's no way Ronnie had done any scouting for that quality of player prior to him being in charge. So none of the players that were chosen could have been Ronnie Dialis. Yes, he might have been given a selection of 10, and he might have chosen two or three out of that 10, but he couldn't have been involved in any way on the scouting of those.
Harry, does that not make it all the more important that he gets his first choices this summer? Well, to make sure that we navigate through these Champions League qualifiers. I think the fact that he was new in, he was fresh, he didn't have a lot of time, he certainly wasn't prepared to manage a club of their stature into Champions League qualifiers, and he's managed to turn things around and win the vast majority of fans over. It will be completely different if we don't qualify for the Champions League this summer.
Once.
Mark made a really good point earlier on that I'm kind of worried in terms of buying it is our window, our vision is getting narrower and narrower, right? We've just signed a centre-half from Man City. I have no idea what the boy's like. I'm presuming, I mean, he looks like a great physical specimen, so he's probably going to be a decent enough player. But this guy, I mean, jumping ahead to the season celebration, you know, Effie Ambrose brings on his agent, Doohan, about his name. He seems to be the sole conduit for flips for us now. You know, and he hasn't done a terrible job. But, you know, we're narrowing our options. You know, Mark was pointing out, we should have a much... I mean, John Park gets all this praise, and I'm sorry, you know. We're not getting our players through John Park. We're getting our players through Doohan, right? That's who we're getting our players through.
Man City,
which is a Lowell-Sun connection.
Yep.
But we need to be looking, you know, I swear to God, we need to have a guy like Mark. I've said this to people at Parkhead. We need a guy like Mark in South America. We need guys looking in Eastern Europe, because that's where you'll get a £12 million striker that you can get for £2 million. You'd be astonished, Mark, correctly. You can buy an Argentinian international for £1 million. True or false?
Well, Demichelis, maybe. But yeah, I don't want to go on to... I've already gone on and on to Argentina.
Well, tell me this, Bones. You've got your finger in the pulse in the States, and the football is becoming more popular in the States.
Yeah.
Now, a good 2 years ago, Rangers St. Cloudy Arena, who was a decent player.
Great player.
And somebody of that ilk. Is there nobody in the States lurking, maybe a striker that could do a job in Scotland?
I haven't got a Scooby-Doo, is the honest truth. Our newest team is the San Jose Earthquakes, and their striker is got a long name, and he missed a complete sitter in the World Cup last year to get, you know, had a chance against Belgium, and he missed it. I can't mark something or other. I've got no idea, to be honest. But you're bang on, right? The Huns got a couple of really good. They got Lania, they got the right back from Chicago.
Beasley? No, he was
the right back.
He was a great player. Really good player.
No, who was the big centre half that had that just when they went into administration?
Bocanegra.
Another good player. And who was the boy when it was getting to the comical stages and he was punted out? And he went, it was a young guy, starts with a B.
Oh, yeah, Bedoya.
I mean, he's not bad there. And he's playing in the team, you know. Mm-hmm. There was a little whisper last year. I think that Sig Jonsson, I think his name is, plays up front for the States. I think he plays in Holland. And he would be a brilliant signing. He's a great player. And there was a whisper that we were looking at him,
yeah,
but
that's right.
It came to nothing.
Well, a few years ago, the States had a guy, Brian McBride, that played with Fulham. And
that's right.
And every time I know you only see highlights in Match of the Day, but he looked a fantastic player.
Yeah, well, as I say, I'm not offering myself as the Celtic US scout, I'm afraid. I'll be good on Little League Baseball in Mill Valley.
So, but I think you make a valid point in terms of, you know, we need to be scouring some of the less fashionable leagues to find our players. We're not going to pick up many more players from Manchester City or the Premiership or anywhere else in England, for that matter, because very average players in England are going for ridiculous sums of money, and I just don't see us paying that type of money for people that are going to struggle to make it in the Scottish Premiership, far less the Champions League.
Mark?
There was a really interesting point that Dylan made about 6 weeks ago, where he said that Celtic need to be looking at the 17, 18-year-old kids rather than the 24-year-old players, that they're not going to be able to find... That the only way we're going to be able to find a top, you know, the next superstar will be to get a 16, 17-year-old. Which I found a really interesting.
And the other thing that you said that I thought was an interesting, getting back to your point, Lawrence, with John Park and our scouting network, he made a really interesting comment that we need to decide what is quality within our system, our academy system. We have some very good young players who are excellent individuals who can play very well in ones and twos.
Mm-hmm.
But you need people who play and understand team movement and the whole movement of the team. I thought that was an interesting comment that might exhibit, might illustrate why we're not getting youngsters through, that they are people who, you know, you and I have discussed this before, Lawrence, people who at the age of 10, 11 are being told they're brilliant,
yeah,
are then very focused on themselves. And so then they're not. So the impression I get is, he thinks our youth system's full of 11 very talented players, but not people who are capable of playing in a team system.
Yeah, but again, just to get back to Mark Cameron's point, you know, my point is our stream, you know, you have streams coming into your club. We've only got two scouting streams. We've got Duda, and we've got the Man City. Yeah, Dudu, Dadu, really. Sorry.
Is that what he's from?
But he can make fun of my name, so it's a cheap point. But we've only got two streams. We should have 15, 20 streams, you know. And the reason is because the scout department's old school, cliquey, don't want any new voices in there, and it's wrong, and it doesn't fit the kind of club that Ronnie Dyler's talking about.
So now that we've slaughtered the scouting system and criticised the lone Ian and the three left wingers that we brought into the club,
can I say something about the youth, if you like, before we move on? I was talking to a friend of mine it was the last game of the season, and the two of us were commenting on what a great player Armstrong looks. He's come into Celtic, he's played really well. There's a lot more to come for him, and I don't think we're playing him in the best position at the moment out on the left. I think that was a central midfielder. However, the point we were making was that if you look at the youth results when Armstrong played for Dundee United, we were horsing Dundee United. So whoever we had in his position was arguably, at that age, a better player than Armstrong. So what happened to our prospects? The whole thing is Armstrong, he get playing in the first team and he get learning his trade. I accept that. The only point I'm making is we keep winning these youth tournaments, whether it's the League or the Cup, and we're not seeing anybody coming through.
That's a really good point.
Sorry, go on, Mark.
Sorry, thank you. I think that's a really valid point. We obviously have talent coming through at the 16, 17, 18, 19-year-old group, but they never seem to make it into the first team. And my understanding is that, you know, that's something that Ronnie Dyler wants to look at and get these good young Scottish players training with the first team so that they can become better players, and it gives them a greater opportunity to develop into first team players. But the point is absolutely spot on. We have good players coming through, but they never seem to make it. Callum McGregor, Liam Henderson, I mean, there's a couple just now. James Forrest has broke through, but there's very few players coming through our youth ranks, and that's something that really does need to be addressed.
Lawrence?
Two things. Sorry, shut me up if I'm dominating this, but two things. We get the best talent in Scotland. We definitely do, right? Because of who we are. But we're teaching them the wrong things, right? We don't need to win youth cups. Who cares if we win youth cups? Right? It doesn't matter, right? All that matters is they're great players when they're 20, 21, 22. And we're not teaching them the right things. I mean, I tell you who, I would, if I was Peter Lawwell, which you never know, I might be one day in the CEO of Celtic, but I would have Jim McGuinness doing the youth team. It's a guy who understands how they develop, he understands what talent is, understands how to nurture it. It's not about telling kids that you're fantastic. The problem with James Forrest is he's been brilliant right as a teenager, been the best juggler, best dribbler, fastest and all that. But he's not developed the way he should have done. He just hasn't, because we didn't teach him the right stuff when he was in the youth.
Which then gets back to Ronnie Dyler's comment about we need to reassess what is quality. When we say we've got quality, what is quality that we've got? He also made the comment about players coming through and they arrive in the first team having been told they're brilliant, and suddenly they are in training every day with a squad full of international players who have international standards, and that player who, stuff we've talked about, Lawrence, that player who has been getting told they're brilliant, steps into the first team and suddenly finds they are the poorest player in the squad, and they can actually go backwards because they're not capable mentally of coping with the change of being the star to being the all-star.
See, by that, Addies, that you've made there, and I don't disagree with anything you're saying, if you go back to when we won the European Cup, we the best players in Europe, best team in Europe. But we still had boys that went in there, like Danny McGrain and Kenny Dalglish and Davy Hayne, all these guys, who went in, trained with the best players in the continent, and yet still made an impression. So this thing somehow about these boys getting there and they get intimidated playing against guys like Pookie and Baldy. No,
it gets down to how they're being spoken to now. If they are being told they are wonderful from the age of 12, it's then a mindset when they do get in that they think they are wonderful.
And it's not that they're intimidated, it's just that they think they're brilliant, right? And then they get there and they discover that they're, oh, hang on, they're not that brilliant. And they just go, instead of buckling under, they go, oh, don't fancy this. You know, I want to go back into my comfort zone, you know, or I'm no good enough. But what should have happened when they were youths? The emphasis should have just been on hard work. And not in James Forrest. Say to James Forrest, listen, mate, the only way you're going to get in, you better stick in, you better work hard, you better learn your trade. Instead of saying, Jamesy, you're amazing, you're the best player in this league. Oh, 5 goals last night, you're fantastic. That's just the wrong way. It's such an old-fashioned way of nurturing and developing youth talent. And that's the problem. That's why we're not getting them. You know, so when Armstrong and Gold and all that, Ryan Gold and all these boys were at Dundee United, Ian Cathro, a really modern thinking guy, he was a guy that brought these through, and he taught them the right way. It was all about hard work, not getting ahead of yourself. And these guys are modest, hardworking. You know, they're not flat. You won't see Armstrong running about Glasgow in a Maserati or a pair of $300, $500 or £500 trainers, because that's not how these people think, because they've been taught the right way.
On a more positive note, that if anybody was at Celtic Park for the league presentation, I was away on holiday and I missed the game. They beat Rangers 5-2. But was it the Youth Cup final?
I watched that game, believe it or not.
Yeah, so I was unaware of that. So I've come back for holiday and I went to the game and I discovered that they beat Rangers 5-2. Now, they showed you the goals in the screen, in the big screens at Celtic Park. One of the goals was amazing. I mean, I think the boy's name is Nesbitt.
Nesbitt.
What a goal. He went left, he went right in the penalty area. It was Messi-esque. I don't exaggerate when I say that level. That's how. But that's the best goal I've seen at that level in years. So it goes to show there is boys out there with talent. So why are they not making the breakthrough?
Well, I think that's the point. How do you get them from there at 16, 17 to a first team player at 21 to a established first team player at 23, 24 playing every week to an internationalist at 25? And we've done a very poor job of that over the last decade.
I think we'll do a good job now, because I think the guy that's in now, and I know a little bit about the coaching staff. McGuinness, I'm telling you, this guy, Jim McGuinness, this guy is everything. This guy is so far advanced. He changed the world of Gaelic football, this guy. He took a bad team. He's a guy who's a genius. Right? And I think he's going to get his elbows into this youth setup. I watched that game. Rangers were, I would say pish, but that's giving pish a bad name. Nesbitt looks a great little player, right? But, you know, Jamesy Forrest was a great little player 4 or 5 years ago, whatever. And, you know, it's just, how do we take Nesbitt's talent and bring him through? That's going to be the interesting.
And I think the McGuinness thing's interesting, because when we got in McGuinness, and then I remember reading quotes from Neil Lennon that seemed to imply, I've no idea why this guy's here and I'm not going to have him near my team. Whereas Ronnie Dyler has talked about him having in. Ronnie Dyler changed our medical and physio team at the turn of the year, and in the last 3 months of the season, our problems in relation to hamstrings and muscle strains and little tweaks, our injury record has improved 760% on the same period last season. James Forrest has been fit for the most consecutive number of months he's been fit since he played his first game for Celtic.
Yeah, I'm just laughing. Harry, we've been going for about an hour, right? And we haven't even started the first league game.
But Harry, that's a brilliant point, and we've spoke about that already. It shows you the transformation, and for Ronnie Dyla to get there, he's obviously had to change a lot of things very quickly. And back to my earlier point, he must be standing up to the CEO and the board and making pretty radical changes at Lennox Town.
Well, getting back to Lawrence's point of we've not even started the first league game. So I will ask for somebody to say, you give me your thoughts first on the first quarter of the season. For people listening, by the 31st of October, Celtic were third in the table, Hamilton were top, Inverness were second, Celtic were third, and Aberdeen were sixth, and there was no team called Rangers. So, Saint, what's your recollections of the first quarter? Anything that stood out, good or bad, in the first quarter of the season?
I had grave concerns, I have to confess. There isn't any point lying about it. As much as I'm happy at the outcome and how things went, I felt, for example, that he was playing square pegs and round holes for me at one point. I mean, playing Mulgrew in midfield just was painful viewing. And he was unfortunate that Scott Brown was injured, because if Scott Brown clearly had been fit, Mulgrew wouldn't have been playing in midfield.
But people are bemoaning the fact that Mulgrew's not been fit for the last few Scotland games to play in the middle of the park.
Well, their standards and our standards might be slightly different. The other thing as well that amazed me about Ronnie Dyla was playing Stokes in the left wing. With the greatest respect in the world, Stokes isn't he's not a winger in any shape or form. And again, it was painful viewing, watching Stokes, because he was trying his best, and him and Izaguirre just ran into one another, and I felt that when Stokes was out of the team towards the end of the season and Armstrong came into the team, that things definitely improved in that front. But getting back to what you were saying there, it was Ronnie took time to find his feet. But the other thing as well that I was really glad of, he established a rapport very quickly with the supporters, which saw him through a bad period. And he also created a lot of goodwill with the supporters. And the reason why I mention that is I always feel that Gordon Strachan, for all his success at Celtic, never ever established a rapport with the fans, so that when a wee bad patch came, he had no goodwill to fall back in. And I think if Ronnie, obviously having a sticky period, the fans stood by him and they got the reward at the end of the season, because I think they could see what he was trying to achieve.
Mark Cooper.
Well, I was just going to say that the team started playing better when Beaton was playing, right?
Yeah.
The whole flow of the team. We keep the ball better. I have really high hopes for Beaton that next season he could really kick on and kind of dictate the rhythm of how we play. I don't think he's obviously got a lot of quality, and I almost want him to grab hold of the game and take control from, if he gets the ball from a centre back, that it's almost like he's running the midfield. Scott Brown can, you know, cover ground, tackle, win the ball back, but I want Beaton to be our playmaker. Switching the play and holding on to the ball.
And I know what I mentioned the first quarter of the season, but since we're running tight in time, I'll split this into two halves of the season, this comment, because Beaton sort of became the first team regular halfway through the season, and I know that's also when the team got familiar with itself, but brilliant start from Ronnie Dyla, that in the first 19 games of the season, Celtic lost 15 points, 12 goals, and scored 1.7 goals a game. In the second 19 games of the season, Celtic lost 7 points, conceded 5 goals, and scored 3.8 goals a game. That was the players getting to know him. But for me, that was one of the big influences of Beaton. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, Beaton definitely. and confidence as well. I think the whole season turned on the game up at Aberdeen, to be honest. Yeah, you know, we beat them with 10 men, get up there. I mean, I know for a fact that there's no love lost. That game caused no love lost between our backroom staff and their backroom staff. The quote was, McInnes, shh. So the celebrations after that, you kind of saw the whole thing coming together. So that kind of changed. But the beat on, this football is just mental, isn't it? You know, beat on, probably not a first pick, injuries, he comes in and he's not fantastic, but you can really see a player. You know, we said last year, Lennon would never really give him much of a run, I don't think, if my memory serves. You know, if the guy, you give the guy 10 or 15 games, we'll see what he is. Lo and behold, he gets 10 or 15 games, and we're looking at a pretty good player now, you know.
There's already talk that he could be one of our big sales of £5 million plus.
Oh, absolutely. Well, yeah, well, I see his agent put a story in the paper because Beaton was looking for a pay rise. And of course, the story appears that Beaton's off to Sunderland. I mean, really? See, if I was Peter Lowell, I would chase these boys down the street. The other thing about the difference between the first half and second half is the fitness thing. Again, I know at the start of the year, Dyla couldn't understand. You know, the team had got, they're a lot fitter, all the fitness tests were showing up, they'd lost a lot of weight, and they weren't really gaining the advantage. But looking back in retrospect now, after the season's over, splitting into two halves, I mean, what a contrast between the first half and the second half. And part of that was the team getting to know each other, getting to know the manager, but also part of that was fitness.
The thing that I feel sorry for any Celtic manager now, Lennon suffered from it, and I think Dyla is going to suffer from it, is we're in the unfortunate position is managers kind of get to build a team. Now, each season, in the last, I think, 4 years, 3 years ago, when, well, no, 4 years ago, I think it was Keogh left, and then it was Wanyama, it was next summer, and then last summer it was Hooper and...
Ledley.
And then it was Fraser Foster. So each summer that comes, we are going to lose our best player. And it means that if you're the manager, it's really, really hard to build a team for the future, to build a sort of long-term plan that you may have. And the reason why I bring this up is everybody has had touched on Beaton there. What a signing, sorry, what a player that he was in the second half of the season. And my concern is that this time next summer, then Stefan Johansson or Beaton is going to end up going down south. And there's not a lot we can do to stop that.
I think that's always going to happen with a club like us. And I don't know that there's that much we can do about it. What we need to focus on is getting the most out of these guys when they're here. I mean, part of the thing we deny is, I mean, how much he's come on in the last year and how that can help attract other young talent into the club. Where we are and where we're positioned in Scotland, we're always going to be a club who has to buy cheaply and sell on. So, you know, we're always going to be in a position where these guys are going to go. For me, I think that somebody made the point earlier on, I think it was Lawrence, about how the Aberdeen game changed it. I think for me, the first half of the season, we really, in my mind, we missed Scott Brown. We didn't have it right in the middle of the park. And when things came good, round about November, December time, then, you know, we had Brown and Beaton pretty consistently in the middle of the park. And those guys, for me, with Johansson playing just in front of them, have just been a revelation this season. And there wasn't a lot of sign of that in the first month to 6 weeks. I mean, Scott Brown got injured early doors. We lost at Inverness. We had a disaster at home against Hamilton. So a lot went wrong early in the season. And when the manager got things turned around in the second half of the season, you know, things came really good for us. And there's a lot more to be positive about looking forward to next season.
So, Lawrence, I know you're the one that's most tight for time with us, so I might actually just jump to one bit and then come back to everybody else to allow you. So by the end of January, we were on, after 22 games, we were top of the league, 51 points, and people were talking about a challenge from Aberdeen, who were 3 points behind us with a game in hand. And we finished the season after 30 games on 92 points, 17 points ahead of Aberdeen. So only because you've got to go, what be your overall impression of the season, your overall comment of the season, and your expectation for next season?
Well, I thought it was a great season. You know, obviously we won. Well, the Scottish Cup thing, I still, some things you just can't go over. So, I mean, that, you know, I just can't go over that we wrote that letter. It was just, this is, no, I'm only joking.
No, hey, I think you were completely out of step with everybody else.
I thought it was a great season. Well, we won two trophies, but much more important than that, it's just seen. Like, somebody's flicked a switch at the club, you know? This guy's arrived, and it's like he's flicked a switch where we're talking about the right sort of things, we're doing the right kind of things. We've gone from a club steeped, you know, again, not to knock Neil Lennon, great job and all that, but there's a kind of, you know, that kind of 1990s, it's just a kind of older thing. I'm not saying that Lennon was a dinosaur, but there's just there's another grade of thinking about how to operate a football club, and I feel as if we've jumped over that, you know, the divide onto that side. You know, it's a kind of mystical world that we've talked about for years and years, where, you know, fitness and diet is important, and, you know, developing. I mean, I know for a fact, I mean, I don't know if we've talked to you, but there's a book called Mindset by a Stanford psychologist called Carol Dweck.
Yep.
Right, and I know for a fact that that book's getting passed, and it's an amazing book. I recommend it to anybody. It's about how to develop anything, you know, how to develop talent, sport and talent, how to develop educational systems. It's an incredible book, and I know for a fact that that book has been passed around the backroom staff. It's, you know, it's required reading. Now, Dweck gives talks to English Premier League clubs. She goes and visits, right, and Celtic are in that world now. And that's, to me, that was the greatest achievement of the season. Obviously, we won the league. We shut up all those ditties on Clyde. It was brilliant. But just the idea that we are really, and we're not just talking about it, we actually are doing it. We're a modern, kind of modern thinking, go-ahead football club. My only regret is that we don't gut the scouting system. I cannot believe how much praise our scouting department gets when really we've done well, but it's more by luck than design. And if we did that, we brought the scouting system into line with all the other ideas that Dylan's brought in, and I think we could really, really do something.
It's interesting you mention the scouting system, because he's changed the medical system at Christmas.
Yeah.
He's changed the whole culture of the players and what food is and isn't available and how they eat at Lennox Town. And he has the coaching staff, I know the coaching staff have talked about it, it's the first time they felt like there's a head coach who's trickled down. You know, Ronnie Dyler's whole point is the under-12s, the under-13s, should every team in Celtic should play the same system with the same ethos. Maybe the coaching will be the next thing.
Oh, the scouting.
The scouting.
Well, the only thing is, the way the diet stuff, he did that the wrong way. That was a kind of, I mean, going public and all that, that was bad, you know. That was just, but I mean, I didn't even know he changed the medical staff, Harry. You bring it up there, you know, and it's done quietly. That's how everything should be done, you know. You don't want Pep Guardiola humiliating the medical staff on worldwide TV. But maybe you should go on ScotSport with the head scout's name? John Park. And give him a good dressing down and then put him out the door. That'd be awesome. Anyway, but as I say, that's the biggest thing for me. You know, and you've got to laugh. We listen to those numpties on the Rangers podcast on the BBC. You know, the BBC do that Rangers podcast.
With the Dave King fan club.
Oh, it's just unbelievable. But, you know, it's just brilliant. Because they're not light years behind us. They are, what's after light years? There's something else, isn't
there?
Oh, it's quite funny. Because I was listening to it, and basically, it was, I was listening to last night's Walking the Dog Tonight, and there was a bit where, it was whatever it was, I was listening to it, and there was a guy, Waddle, the Dave King fan club, Richard Wilson, was talking about what he wanted for the next Rangers, for the new Rangers, and it was Waddle and Spears both said the same thing. You've just described Ronnie Dyler.
Yeah, you're dead right, and Lefty Boy makes a great, you know, he's not getting in that and shouting and bawling at the board. I mean, not that I know, but you get a sense it's not his style. But he's going in and making very, very persuasive case for whatever he wants, and they have been seems to me that they have been flexible enough, you know, to give him his head. I mean, it's again, it's a club working in in unison, as opposed to, you know, this kind of constant warfare. And, you know, that's the sense that I get. But I mean, I don't know anything anyway, so.
Lawrence, think how good it could be if he could coach Scott Brown to pass a ball and he played two up front.
No, right, Lawrence, you need to go there. I'm going to let Mark Cooper, because I'm going to slaughter the two up front thing. So, Lawrence, thanks for your time.
No bother.
Cheers.
Good voice.
Cheers.
Thanks, Lawrence.
See you, Lawrence.
See you, Lawrence.
Right, Mark Cooper, you have a go and have your say.
About, what about, next season and the expectations of next season?
Well, first of all, about the nonsense has just come from my right about two.
Did you see Barcelona versus Bayern Munich the other week?
Yeah.
Where they had nominally one up front with two wide players that Neymar and Suarez and Messi. But whenever they were getting into positions, they would have two players coming in from the flanks who were there for the tap-ins or whatever. I don't think it matters. I don't think it matters whatever the kind of nominal formation is. If people arrive in the positions when you're crossing a ball, cutting a ball back, it's fine, right? You also need five players in midfield to actually hold the ball in Europe. If we have like two flat lines, right, or four in Europe with two up front, then it's going to be like almost impossible to hold the ball away from home, right?
So, no? Mark Cameron, you've been to a lot of our games. That would be putting it mildly.
Sure.
What's your points of two up front?
To be quite honest, a couple of things stick out, the most recent of which was the Aberdeen game where Scott Brown runs, 85 yards to score a goal. Now, previously, under Neil Lennon, that would never have happened. He would never have been the furthest player forward to put the ball in the net. So what that tells me is that people are moving, obviously moving further during the game, and the midfield is pushing much further forward. So to me, whether you have one up front or six up front, it's all about, as Matt said, the formation of the team and how they're playing and how we're getting the ball into the box. For me, it doesn't need to be two up front. Absolutely not. If Scott Brown ends up being the furthest player forward to receive a pass along pretty much along the goal line to tap in a winning goal, then that's fantastic. The other thing that we spoke about in a previous podcast, Harry, was about the two fullbacks being in the opposing box.
Yeah.
Now, if you've got two of your fullbacks in the opposing penalty box, you must be doing something right. And it doesn't, again, you don't need to have two up front or a 4-4-2. The players make the formation, and players running in the right positions is what is critical. So for me, no, a 4-4. It doesn't have to be a 4-4-2.
You're making a good point there, Mark, but because really part of my criticism earlier on in the season was he was playing a formation that didn't suit the players at his disposal. Hence, Mulgrew being in midfield, Stokes being in the left. And I think what was noticeable after the new year was Beaton came in the middle of the park, made a big difference. And Griffiths made a difference up front because he was more mobile than Guidetti.
Agreed.
And he's a better finisher as well, to be honest. But more importantly than that, when Mackay Stephen and Armstrong came in, they hit the ground running and they looked more comfortable playing in that dial 4-2-3-1, whatever you want to describe it, in the system that Dial was trying to play. These two guys fitted it like a glove. And after the new year, when I think Ronnie came to terms with the players that suited the system rather than the system suiting the players, it was noticeable that the results began to improve.
I think for me a huge part of it centred around the Brown Beaton Johansson formation. I think that really allowed us to step up a gear, and you wouldn't be able to play those three if you had two strikers, I don't think. So we Brown and Beaton, and then Johansson in front of them. It's allowing you to get your two guys wide, and you're absolutely right. Lee Griffiths in the second half of the season was just a revelation, and he was exactly what we needed. Certainly a lot more mobile than Guidetti. But if you think back to October, November, Lee Griffiths wasn't even getting quoted. He was absolutely nowhere.
And to be fair to Guidetti, he was basically carrying the team at that point. There was one point around about October, he was the only guy that was scoring the entire team, which was a big concern at that time.
The thing about Griffiths is interesting, because getting back to the point Lawrence was making about the mindset of why young players don't get through, one of the things that I've been told by people who've seen him, I was at Celtic Park, bumped into someone who'd seen Griffiths when he was 15, 16, and he was a million miles better than anybody else. Spoke to someone who was at Livingston when Griffiths was coming through at Livingston, and he was a million miles better than anyone else. And then again in Dundee and Hibs. But the comment that those people were making was, and see, when he came to Celtic, he was the same player that they'd seen at 16, 17. Because he was so much better than everyone else at 16 and 17, was getting told he was brilliant, he hadn't developed. So for me, the thing in relation to Griffiths is, he's someone who, at some point between, as you say, September, October, when mm-hmm. he wasn't even making the bench, mm-hmm. and by the end of the season, at some point, he's worked out what he needs to do to become a better football player.
I think, did they not say that in the press just the other day, that he figured out that he was going to have to work really hard?
Yeah, Mark.
To get into this team. I mean, one of the things I'll throw out there is, you know, has Callum McGregor really improved in the last year? Has James Forrest? Not for me. None of those two guys have really improved. So once people are getting into the, or start to break into the first team, there's still a huge step from that point to them becoming a first team regular. And that's the one or two players who actually make it through our youth academy.
Mark Cooper?
I think Griffiths has obviously had a really good season and has improved, but I doubt that he can hold the ball up that well and receive the ball back to goal in Europe. But I do have concerns about playing in the Champions League with Griffiths up front. I think he's a good outlet, maybe on a counter-attack or something, but for him to be like the number 9 lone striker up front, we saw it against Inter Milan, that the ball was bouncing off him.
Mm.
Do you know the interesting thing I heard today? That Ronnie Dyler believes that Skepovic is the only player at the club. Sorry, Skepovic is the nearest player at the club to what he's looking for in a striker. But the problem is, Skepovic himself doesn't believe it.
Do you think Skepovic actually wants to be here?
That's debatable.
It doesn't look. Well, the comment I heard was he just lacks self-confidence. And that's his problem.
There's also stories about his wife's not happy here in terms of the climate and the way of life, and would prefer to go back to Spain to better weather.
Basically. Who would be happy with the climate? Because you two, us two, Steve and Saint, and we're the only two who are suffering the... Mark Cooper, Mark Cameron, you'll know this, Mark Cooper. We are getting, and for all our listeners overseas, see weather in the last 2 weeks here in Glasgow, you get it's November weather. I'm not kidding. I drove home the other day, it was 6 degrees at 5:30 at night. So no wonder she doesn't like the weather anyway. That's my...
See, she's talking about the climate there. Fergus McCann came up with a great quote that always sticks in my mind. And somebody was trying to say to him, oh, Fergus, you're trying to sign this guy for Germany. You're trying to sign this guy for Spain. And he was trying to explain it. And his quote was, let's face it, they don't come here for the climate. Which was Fergus's way of saying, the reason we get players here is we pay more than anybody else. If they could get more money, they would go to England or one of the bigger leagues.
Yeah, I think that's a perfectly valid point, and Fergus was right. It was all to do with the terms and conditions. Nobody's going to come to Scotland for the climate, so when we bring people in, you know, we need to make sure that they're going to settle in and adjust. And that's part of the attraction for me of bringing through the very best young Scottish talent, because they're used to the climate, they're used to playing in some of these soggy, wet pitches on a Tuesday night with maybe hail or snow coming down.
So if I move off the squad for a minute and focus on mentioning the league campaign, did anybody actually genuinely think we were getting a challenge from Aberdeen? See,
I did at one stage. There was a same run about early January. Aberdeen went on a run. Now, I noticed one of you said earlier on there that Celtic, the turning point was November, December. The turning point for me was the Kilmarnock game right after the break, because the game before New Year was Ross County at home at Celtic Park, and it was an awful game, and we drew nothing each. And my recollection is coming out of Celtic Park that day and being pretty despondent about the future, because Aberdeen were right behind us. I think they actually, I'm sure that there was one point whether if they won a game in hand, they were in front of us, but we had a game in hand. That's what it was. And there was a wee period in about January, February, to be fair to Aberdeen, that they did put up, looked as if they were going to come together with a challenge. But the problem with Aberdeen was everybody looks at the 4-0 game at Celtic Park as like the rod that broke Aberdeen's back. That was there. They could actually have afforded to take that defeat. There was two games before that. They drew 3 each with Dundee after they were 3-1 up, and they drew 1 each with St Johnstone. And they were bad results. That was 4 points that they blew. So the 3 points at Celtic Park should have been that much a difference in the great scheme of things if they'd have took those 4 points. And one of Brian's pals, nice guy, Ali Begg. I remember Ali Begg on Twitter when they drew 3 each with Dundee saying what a great result it was. They were 3-0 down with 3 minutes to go and they come back to 3 each. And I remember laughing at that and thinking, no, that's a bad result. You didn't gain a point, you lost 2.
For me, I think I actually said at one point round about the end of January that if we didn't win the league before the split, then it would be a disappointment. So to answer your question, Harry, did I see a serious threat coming from Aberdeen? I didn't really. I felt they would fall away. And to be fair to them, they put in more of a challenge than what I thought. But really, for us, in my mind, you know, we should be winning the SPL reasonably comfortably, and our focus needs to be on Europe.
What do you think the chances are that we'll qualify for Champions League? Like, what percentage would you guys put on that?
Far bigger than this time last year, Mark.
Yes, I agree with that.
The reason being because we've got a manager who's settled, we've hopefully got a stronger squad. But again, the danger is always going to be the draw. If you get a Carrigandy, if you get an Elfsborg, if you get a Helsinki, then with the greatest respect, and I don't take anything for granted in Europe because I've got a great admiration, particularly for the Scandinavian teams and how they go about their business. That's teams we should be beating. But we need to be careful that there might be a Dynamo Zagreb in there somewhere, or a Dynamo Kiev, who their coefficient in the last couple of years might have plummeted, who are still a big danger and come for a good footballing league and a good footballing background. That's a big danger for me.
Mark, you asked the question.
As a percentage, I'd agree with Saints' points, and there's a lot of continuity in the team. I think even with this squad, we should be, without anyone coming in, we should be qualifying, I think. But it'll be interesting to see what happens with Van Dijk, because if we're going into these games with Boyata and Ambrose at the back two against, as Shane says, a fairly decent Eastern European team level of Legia Warsaw, I'd be pretty nervous about that, to be honest.
I understand we've come to an agreement with Van Dijk that he will play the Champions League qualifiers and then he can go to whoever puts in a bid as soon as we are through the Champions League qualifiers, unless somebody comes in with a massive bid that we, Arsenal or Man United or something come in. It's the right club for him. I believe that we've told him that he's good enough to go to an Arsenal, Man United type club, and he shouldn't leave to go to a mid-table Premiership team. And the likes of Man United, Arsenal tend to
be later in the transfer window anyway. And I believe that we and him, we mucked him about last season with an indication of that type of deal, but nothing set up in stone. And this time, I think we've been a bit more mature about it and said, this is the deal. We need you for these games. Once we're through these games, thanks very much. We'd like you to stay, but we understand you won't.
My input on, first of all, on the Champions League qualification, I wouldn't say we're much above 60% if you're looking for a percentage number. I think there's banana skins out there. There's honest mistakes out there. There's bad performances out there. I'm concerned about the qualification for the Champions League. I think there are a lot of decent clubs that we could face, and it might come down to a little bit of luck of the draw. But in terms of, are we guaranteed or anywhere close to being guaranteed to qualify for the Champions League, I don't think we're anywhere near that. I think there's certainly good teams up there. And touching a little bit on Harry's point there, about players, we still need to see what Ronnie's going to do in his first real full transfer window. So there's a lot, for me, there's a lot of work still to be done. I think he's going to want to shift several players, and he's going to have to bring in players who are much better and are going to enhance the first team as opposed to just being squad players.
It might be quite interesting to see what happens with the Norwegian boy at Real Madrid, Odegaard, because he hasn't had a look in.
He played. Did he not come on their last game of the season and became the youngest ever Real Madrid player?
Okay.
And what Mark's saying, though, he's not going to be a first teamer, so.
No, but he's not.
Yeah. Might want to put him on loan for a season, even, and you could take advantage of that.
There has been talk of that. Mm-hmm.
That would have surprised me. But what is Odegaard? Is he a playmaker or is he a striker? Or?
He's a playmaker.
So is he the sort of number 10?
But I actually think that we do actually need, I've said this for about 3-4 years, an equivalent of James Forrest high up on the left. Because as you've seen before, I know we have Matthijs Steven, but as you've seen before, Armstrong's been playing there, but that's not really his position. His ideal position, I think everyone would agree, is Stephen Johansson's position.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I would agree with that.
So, yeah, I was just thinking there about Odegaard could be I don't know how old he is, 17, 18.
The other interesting thing, because Ronnie Dyla, when asked about the playing two strikers up front, said two strikers up front can be useful when you're chasing a game. Getting back to your point, Mark, about the playing 4-4-2 is very one-dimensional. Whereas if you have a number 10, a number 10 gives you three options, whereas a 4-4-2 only gives you two options or one option. But the other thing that was interesting about that was he then followed that up by saying, however, you cannot go into a season with only one system. We principally had one season this system because this season, that one system this season, because we were changing so much about the team that we didn't want to confuse the players with another system changing. But next season, we'd like to have two, possibly three systems, and the backup system should be three up front with a 4-3-3.
It's funny, like 4-3-3 and 4-2-3-1. I often think it's, you know, using these numbers, it's a bit, it's ridiculous because, like, we can kind of criticise 4-4-2, but if one of the strikers, say, a kind of like Peter Beardsley-type striker, you can argue that he's the most attacking midfielder as well. There's probably about a 5 yards difference on the pitch or something.
Oh, yeah.
So it's kind of...
Our 4-2-3-1, as we've discussed before, most of the time we were playing with two centre-halves, then occasionally either Beaton or Brown would drop between the two centre-halves to almost make it a three at the back at times. Our two full-backs were in the opposition box, so at times it was more of a 3-1-3-3, if I can get the numbers right. You know, your point, Mark, is I think it's sometimes a bit rigid to talk in it's this system or that system. It's about having X number of players who are more defensively orientated on the park and Y number of players who are in a more attacking orientated position in the park?
Yeah, for me, the formation and the movement around the park, as you said there, Harry, you know, at times it was almost like you're playing with two centre halves and a sweeper in front of them, allowing the two full backs to push forward. And we've seen a lot of that this season where Ezeghiri and Matthews or Lustig were pushing well forward up the park, and that's helping create space for movement for your two sitting midfielders and also for your two wide players. So if Ronnie can bring in another system where we're still going to have the same movement, then as long as it's not confusing the players, why would you not give it a try? Because I think you certainly need something different for European ties, especially those away from home.
Okay, so I try not to have a podcast that's more than that's too long. Partly just one of the things is the size of the file to download. If you want to listen to it, becomes too big if it's too long. So, final thing, we've pretty much done the season. So, the final thing you touched on at the amount with your question about the Champions League qualifying for next season. Is there anything anybody specifically wants to talk about this mention about this season before I move on to I'll move on to the last question of what's your expectation for the coming season? We've talked about Champions League. What's your expectation domestically? So, Mark Cameron, you go first.
Domestically, I think we'll win the league. I would be delighted if we could go one step better and get the treble. So that has to be the aim. So my expectation is that we're going to have a serious tilt at the treble, and barring honest mistakes, I think Ronnie will deliver.
Saint, I would forsake both the cup competitions if you could guarantee me a Champions League qualification, because I think it adds more to our season. And I know winning a treble is a great achievement over a long space of time, but these days, I don't know. I'm not that impressed when it comes to trebles. If you could have a Champions League, if you qualify for the Champions League group stages, and even to finish third and get into the Europa League after Christmas, I would bite your hand off.
Mark Cooper,
I agree with that. I think the aim should be to be competitive in the Champions League group, not just qualify and, you know, get 3 points like Maribor. To be competitive again, that's where we should be at. Also, to add, I'd like Henderson to be getting 20-25 games next season, and the boy Nesbitt to start to be pushing for quite a few games.
Who's out of your team then for Henderson's 2025?
You don't have to play Brown every single game. Like when we're at home against, you know, St Mirren or whatever, Ross County, and he's already, you know, like, he's playing every single week and we'll have a Champions League game to play in November or whatever. You can put Henderson in there. He needs minutes.
It's interesting because I've just remembered one of the other things Ronnie Dyle had said was he has more confidence in the players now to be able to rest people like Scott Brown than he did last season. So maybe you'll get your wish, Mark. I kept everyone long enough. Lawrence has already had to go for his mini-league scouting. Mark's finishing in his torture chamber there. He's just driven a motorbike over somebody's legs. Mark Cameron is he's frozen solid there out in Spain.
The weather's lovely here, Harry. It's slightly more than the 6 degrees you've got in Glasgow, that's for sure.
And St Anthony, he's already started his third book since we started this podcast. So I'd just like to say thanks everyone for your input in its various points in the last 250 podcasts of Celtic Underground, and speak to you again all soon. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot.
Sunshine in your smile, bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness, so much joy.
So I hope you enjoyed that
And once again, I'm on to Benji Reid about the Celtic FC Foundation. And there is a special event happening, if you're listening to this prior to it occurring, at Barrowfield on Saturday, with a Celtic supporters charity match in memory of Gerry McDade. Gerry was a well-known Celtic supporter amongst many, and Poolsman and his son has organised this fantastic event taking place at Barrowfield. You're quite entitled to go along to watch